Building a company from nothing is freaking hard. Us entrepreneurs are expected to deal with unimaginable challenges and somehow keep a cool head through it all. This is The Art of Entrepreneurship, and I'm your host, Jackie Hermes. I grew my company, Excelity, from zero to seven figures with no partners and no funding. The Art of Entrepreneurship is a show where we cut through the BS and dig into what it actually takes to start and grow a company. If you give me your time, I promise it won't be wasted. Now let's get to work.
Good morning and welcome back to The Art of Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is kind of a prodigy, and I will say that because he is not here while I'm recording this. But Lior Weinstein founded his first company as a teen, 14 years old. He exited two companies by his 20s. We get into this and kind of where this drive comes from and how he did it in the podcast. We talk a little bit about what the code is for growing a company. I don't think there's really some kind of special magical formula, but Lior has found a way to consistently grow and exit businesses, and his process is much more methodical and predictable than you would think. Like I said, it's not magic. We also get into why micromanagement doesn't work, and his perspective on why leaders are micromanaging in the first place. It's a fascinating conversation, and I'm excited that you're here to listen today. Welcome, Lior.
So you founded your first company at 14, which is wild, very young. I have two 14-year-olds myself, and thinking about them starting companies is kind of crazy. So when I was reading your bio, I was shocked. And then you exited two companies in your 20s. That level of business acumen, I think, is pretty unheard of by most. Tell us about your first business and what drove you to start it.
Very first business was, we called the company Creative Game Bears, or Game Berry. And so this was, you're talking about, you know, late 90s, something like that. So we were creating games for digital TV receivers. So this was the age where like TiVo came out. Right. Mm-hmm. And PlayStation, mm-hmm. the first PlayStation, and digital TV receivers came out and they had like a memory chip. And I'm like, we can create games for this. And this was back in Israel, where I'm from. And I just kind of banded with a few friends who were very talented, talented coders, talented designers. And I was the kind of the classic entrepreneur, like, here's an idea, found a client, you know, that's going to pay us money, and then assemble the team. And suddenly we're making money. Now, at the time, I'm trying to think about the equivalent, maybe like $500 a month or something, which was a lot of money for a 14-year-old at the time. But it was really a service-based business. And as far as like why, one, I wanted to make money. So I think a lot of kids and a lot of adults have that motivation as well. But certainly when you're a kid, you want to, you know, make money, buy your own stuff, buy whatever you want. And I just had the idea and nobody told me I shouldn't. So like both of my parents are entrepreneurs, very different than each other. My dad was kind of in insurance sales, grew up to be a CEO of a very large insurance agency. And my mom was an architect and interior designer, so self-employed. And my grandfather was a carpenter with his own like furniture store. So definitely runs in the family by osmosis. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we were, you know, sitting around the dinner table talking about building businesses or anything like that. But I think the general inclination is to think you want to do something so you can do it. And the first signal of that was in the company. It was like school projects, right? Like leading the class, you know, newspaper, you know, or managing, being a director of a play at school, you know, stuff like that. So stuff that are, let's have a vision, assemble people towards it, and then like make it up and make it real. So it's definitely innate. And because nobody told me I shouldn't, I just decided to do it.
I love that. My 14-year-old son just started working at my agency, actually, and he's making like $50 a week, and he is thrilled. He couldn't be happier because now he has video game money, right? And he has money to spend on his own. So I love that. Nobody told you you couldn't. Do you think a lot of people are telling kids and young people that they can't?
I think that the issue of permission is a big deal for humans and certainly for entrepreneurs. Even today, and I've been an entrepreneur effectively all my life, and I have friends who are incredible entrepreneurs, very successful. We talk about this issue of permission all the time. Like sometimes we find ourselves that for whatever reason, we feel way better to execute on something with somebody else echoes and is like, yeah, you should totally do it. Even with high performing entrepreneurs. So I think one is permission. It's not so much you shouldn't do, although certainly some people are in those circles where they talk about an idea, they talk about an aspiration, and the feedback they get from their immediate circles is, oh, you shouldn't do it, or it's crazy, it's expensive, it's risky. Entrepreneurs are generally a very small portion of the population to begin with. So most likely, if you are one, you don't have a lot of people around you. So I recommend you get around those people, put yourself in different places. So one is, yeah, in some cases, people do get rejected and they get advice not to do it. The other is just, you know, in modern times, certainly in the Western world, you live on certain tracks, right? You go to preschool, you go to kindergarten, you go to school, you have semesters and tests and grades and extracurricular activities and college prep, and then college. Like you're looking for these well-laid tracks of many, many millions before you. And normally the tracks are not building a company or doing something on your own. It's falling into a certain place. So there's a lot of inertia, a lot of resistance for you to do things that are abnormal. So with all of that, meaning if you don't have the inherent drive to do it, I think people have inherent creativity. They want to do something. So if you don't have the initial support, you're not gonna get enough energy, enough lift, enough gas to kind of go to escape velocity with the idea and make it happen.
Yeah, when I started my first business, which was a food company, there was a lot of, I don't know if that sounds like a good idea, or a lot of pushback. Are you sure you're ready for that risk? And it was like, yeah, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? And if I can look at those things and understand the sacrifices that I'm willing to make, then sure. Yeah, I'm ready. And I know what my fallbacks can be. And I think everyone's kind of risk tolerance is different, right? So I definitely think you talked about how entrepreneurs don't have a lot of those people around them. Having those support systems is definitely key. You have exited a number of companies and you've started even more than that. Did you know that you wanted to be a serial entrepreneur, or is that something that you learned as you went along?
No, and definitely didn't know. And I think I would say it's a more common label these days, right? Serial entrepreneurs. Yeah. I think in many cases, even in the entrepreneurship circles, it's not necessarily a positive label. Like a lot of it is perspective. Some people, you know, look at serial entrepreneurs and say, oh, you can't, you know, do one thing. And then you have entire philosophies about the one thing that's the one thing and the one thing, right? So it's one, I think it's a more modern label than it is historically. And it's also not necessarily positive. For me, it is. I mean, it is an accurate label and a positive label, you know, at the same time. I think I always knew that I wanted to keep creating. I think I was fighting in my 20s because I had friends that went through a more normal track of, you know, school and job and very successful at those things and very happy. Like, it's not like they got, you know, disgruntled or have a bad life. They have a great life and certainly simpler. Entrepreneurship is not a simple life. You know, there's a running joke when people go entrepreneurs that you quit a 9-to-5 to work 24/7.
Don't I know it?
Yeah, it's real. And at the same time, I can't really think about anything else, because that is the life that I'm creating and I want to create and keep expanding. I like it. I think I didn't know ahead of time that that's how my life is going to go. I also don't know what I'm going to do when I grow up. Like, at the same time, I like the variety. I can totally see, by the way, in some weird circumstance, I'm going to find myself working on a single company for like a few decades. Not likely, but I'm not, you know, at this point, maybe it'll happen.
Yeah, you're not ruling it out. No. I don't think serial entrepreneur is a negative label, at least in my eyes. I know a lot of people talk about that one thing. And to me, that label is more about like finding that one thing you're really good at and surrounding yourself with people that are good at the things that you're not good at and, you know, things like that. And I think you can apply that to lots of different businesses, right? And so you can be a serial entrepreneur and still be deeply good at one thing. So I know lots of serial entrepreneurs that are extremely successful. And if you can continually found, build companies, make a great lifestyle for people, help them make money with an exit, I mean, fantastic. You know, I think that's great for everyone. So I definitely personally don't think that's negative.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would have a lot of self-loathe if I thought.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So it seems like with your many companies, you have cracked some kind of code for growth, if there is such a thing. I'm not convinced that there is, but you have managed to continually grow multiple companies. Tell us how and what that growth code looks like for you.
I came up with a few years ago, I ended up creating a marketing and technology agency, and we were a performance agency. So we took, you know, fixed retainers and unlimited upside, and that company grew quite a bit. I mean, we grew to almost seven figures a month by the end of the first year, and mostly on performance, mostly on commissions and net new revenue we're creating for the clients. And when I started it, I told the clients, I can't promise you results. I just can't. And I think a lot of agencies try to do that. Like, oh, don't worry, you know, pay me money and this is exactly what's going to happen. I'm like, I'm not a prophet. I don't know. Can't promise you results. I can promise you effort and a process.
Right.
And the process, I kind of explained to them, I told them, we're going to create an environment where growth is inevitable. And the way we do that is I like to plan quarterly, and I like to use like technology concepts for project management, like sprints. And apply them to other creative endeavors like marketing. So we're going to come up with a list of experiments, be very scientific about it. Here's the hypothesis. Here's what we think is going to happen if we execute on this. And here's the resources we're going to apply and going to make sure that it's a viable minimal product and not just like a minimal product in terms of a project. And whatever works, we're going to do more. And whatever doesn't, we're going to stop. And if we only end up with the things that work, then the flywheel is going to get there, escape velocity is going to hit, and we'll be in orbit. That framework, I said we're going to do one of three things. We're either going to de-risk the company, we're either going to unclog it, like reduce or remove constraints, or we're going to scale the company. And if we do it in that way, growth is inevitable. And that's really the framework I use. Also for personal life, like if you want to lose weight, learn a language, whatever that is, and certainly for business. So I did systemize it in that way where I kind of think, what's the purpose of the project through those three lenses? What are the resources? What's the ideal outcome if this project is successful? What's the worst case scenario if we don't do the project? That's a lot of people are so in love with ideas. I'm like, well, let's just picture this. Let's say we don't do. What happens? Just that alone really helps you understand if the priority is relevant. Yeah, so I definitely use that consistently. And over the years, now some market, that means you require more, you need budget for experiments, right? It's not like you can run experiments for $5. Sometimes you can, but you need budget. So as long as you have enough budget for experimenting, until you find or until you create the environment where growth is inevitable, then you can hit it. And then you just go into resources. I'm a very MacGyver-esque kind of philosophy on creating things. Like, give me the duct tape, the chewing gum, like all day long. So I don't like to over-engineer, and I treat all money like it's my money. I never treat it as like other people's money, even if there's a lot of resources, even if we're like, and sometimes that happens to me. I work with partners who are like, yeah, we have a $10 million budget for this or an $80 million budget for that. I'm like, well, I need 8,000 because that's what I would do. That's how I would attack this particular problem. And if this is it, maybe I'll spend 8 million later. But right now, for the next proof of life on this idea, that's what I need. So I think combining those concepts with just having a relationship with the funds, like it's my money and it's personal, then it allows me to consistently create growth in a predictable way.
If you go on our website, you will see that we talk about spending client money like our own. And I think that that is so important because there are lots of people that will just take your money and, you know, just spend it and say, oh, okay, well, we tried something, it worked or it didn't. And that's that, right? Yeah. Especially you're talking about marketing in the marketing field. I just actually had someone come to me and ask about working with us. And I said, I think you're going to be a lot better off doing this, this, and this, like finding this kind of resource. This is a lot better spend with, and, you know, come back to us when you have grown to this point. But I'm happy to give those answers because that's how I would spend my money, right? So I love that philosophy. Okay, just a couple more questions here. I know we're coming up on our time. So right before we hopped on, I was looking at your LinkedIn and you posted about a get the job done policy. I think you opened up with something like your friend got a new job and a tan, which is not something that often happens. Great hook, by the way. I was like, where is this going? I think I need to read more. The zero micromanagement policy, which there is no micromanagement within my company. I hated being micromanaged as an employee, and I would never micromanage as a leader. That is just not the way to get anyone to get anything done. And most bosses are extremely uncomfortable with that. Like, I remember during COVID, every leader was like, you need to, oh, your team's working from home. You better put software on their computers so you can see what they're doing.
Yeah, track their mouse movements, track their times, right?
I was like, are you nuts? Like, absolutely not.
No.
Why do you think people are so uncomfortable with policies like this?
First of all, I think there's an essential difference between leaders and managers. Leaders generally, you know, create capabilities, and managers manage existing capabilities. I'm a great leader. I'm not a great manager, meaning I'm really good at like fabricating a new system and a new process. There are people that are way better at me and making sure that process is pristine, right? Like all the I's, all the T's, like it's just, you know, perfect and it's fast and efficient and so on. So I think, first of all, there's a natural difference between those two positions and understanding as a person and as a position, which one are you? Now, what is leadership? Leadership, you're leading people, right? You're not leading processes, you're leading people. And I think most people are stuck in the management doctrine, in the management philosophy, and not in the leadership one. So they're thinking this result needs to happen, and the way to make it happen is use a product or use a person. And there's a best way for it to happen. And if it's something that's not the best way, it means it's not going to be the best result. And then they emotionally, you know, react to it. I think leaders are more, you know, because we're people focused, we're more tuned into the emotions, to the empathy, to the experience. Are people happy? Mm-hmm. Generally, also, when I come into new companies, I kind of say, here's how I optimize. Happy, effective, and efficient in that order. Efficient is the last thing I do. And for most people, it's the first thing they do. Mm-hmm. They kind of look at a process that's ongoing and they're immediately like, you know, here's the 20 ways it should change. But I'm like, okay, I get that. We'll get there. We'll definitely get to efficiency. No doubt about it. But is it creating the result that we're looking for? Is it effective? If not, let's make sure that first. And then are the people happy? Because if they're not happy, they're going to leave. People yes. don't leave companies. They leave people. Mm-hmm. And I think the discomfort comes from how people perceive their self-identity and self-worth through the lens of, did I do a good job? And I think that's from childhood, right? Even with my kids, and oh, you did a great job, sweetie. And I'm trying to, and every time I said it, I'm like, I need to change it. Because I don't want their self-worth to come from, one, the word job to begin with. Mm-hmm. And their self-worth to come from good because they did like a result. So I think it's something that's from childhood and certainly reinforced by social standards. And then they get to the workplace. And here's the reality. And unfortunately, in many cases, they're also right, because when they don't do a good job, they get fired by managers that also hold them to that standard.
Yep. Right? Yep.
And there's usually a huge difference between the C-suite of a company and any other level down. And I've seen it time and time again, even working with clients, and I work with some like these Fortune 100, Fortune 50 companies, there's a chasm between the actual C-suite, the CEO, the CTO, the CFO, and all the VPs. And you see the C-suite is usually like very people-oriented, you know, thinking about the experience. And of course, they're great business people. They're thinking about the business, but their orientation is human. And as soon as you go down, it instantly becomes like judgment of, are people doing a good job first? So it's natural, unfortunate. And I recommend to anybody that is optimizing towards that, if you optimize for happy colleagues and happy employees and happy bosses, maybe you're managing up, you're going to have a better life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we definitely like to optimize for happiness. I don't know what the stat is, but the percentage of time that you spend at work is insane. And we talk about all the time, we might as well be having fun. Like, if I'm not having fun at work and enjoying working with my colleagues, I don't want to be here. So that is one of the main focuses at Excelity. Okay, last question. Are there any topics that we didn't cover today but should have?
I think there's two topics I like talking a lot about. One is AI, and the other is freedom of entrepreneurship. Both are great. And I guess if theme-wise, let's try to talk about a little bit of both. A few years ago, I got introduced and I joined this company called Strategic Coach. Huge shout out, love them, love Dan Sullivan. And Dan Sullivan became my coach, and I'm in his kind of group. And Dan has been talking about these four entrepreneurial freedoms if you want to be happy as an entrepreneur, which is freedom of time, freedom of purpose, freedom of money, and freedom of relationship. And that's freedom from and freedom to. And freedom of purpose is, are you choosing to work on whatever you're working on or somebody else choosing for you? Freedom of time is, do you have the time to do this, to, hang out with your kids or read a book or work out, whatever it is. Freedom of money, some people want to buy a tiny house in the Appalachia, some people want to buy, a mansion in New York, whatever freedom of money is to you. And lastly, for me, out of those four, freedom of relationship ended up being the most important one because I realized if I'm spending time with like intelligent and kind and curious people, I'm having a pretty good day. And the segue on AI to that, I think AI, I'm a big optimist in the AI universe. So I'm in that category, that camp. And my big mental model for this is that it's not the end of work, it's the end of boring work. And being able to execute on stuff you really like is and stop doing stuff you don't like. And everybody doesn't like to, my accountant loves accounting. I really don't. I'm okay at it. I'm a decent numbers guy, right? But I certainly am not passionate for it. And so everybody has their boring, whatever boring is, and everybody has boring. So I think the opportunity to relinquish that and then focus on more deeper relationship is incredible. And it blows my mind every single time. I gave another workshop like 6 weeks ago, high-powered entrepreneurs, eight, nine-figure revenue companies in the room, only eight, nine-figure companies in the room. And 80% of them are using ChatGPT like they're using Google. So, like, if you think you're behind the
Fascinating.
curve, I can tell you right now, you are absolutely not.
Get moving. Yeah.
Get moving, you're
You got
good,
time.
and you have to.
Yeah.
You have to. It's going to be absolute negligence not to get involved in whatever level. You don't have to become an expert in anything, but certainly have to take it seriously.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, if you learned something today, please share this with just one person or share it on social and tag us, and I will talk to you next time. Thank you.